There's a family Bible on the table. Its pages worn and hard to read. But the family Bible on the table will ever be my key to memories. At the end of day when work was over, when the evening meal was done, Dad would read to us from the family Bible, and we'd count our many blessings one by one. I can see us sitting round the table, as from the family Bible Dad would read. I can hear my mother softly saying, rock of ages left for me. Now this old world of ours is filled with trouble, but this old world would also better be if we find more Bibles on the table. And mother's singing, rock of ages left for me. I can see us sitting round the table, as from the family Bible Dad would read. And I can hear my mother softly saying, rock of ages left for me. Rock of ages left.
Johnny Cash, a track brought in by Gamma. Have you got anything more to say about that?
Yeah, it's the family Bible. And it's to do with the cash. You know, the mullah. Nasruddin.
I was just going to say that, yeah. Church of American Secular Humanism.
Secular Humanism, mullah, Nasruddin.
I don't think I ever thought of cash before. The acronym for it. Did you ever think of that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So his religion was cash?
Yeah.
C-A-S-H.
Material, is that sociological materialism?
What he said about avoiding taxes as well at one level. So
yeah,
it
yeah.
It was about getting
yeah.
paid because anybody, any religion was exempt.
Well, in the digital environment, cash became king.
Yeah.
Nothing was solid, so you need turnover of cash every day in the economy. Of course, we've inflated that to the quadrillion level and everything's gone now. There's no cash. No more Church of Secular Humanism. Bush was ahead of his time. The fundamentalists were ahead of their time in that sense.
Bring on the Texans.
Republic of Texas. I think the ambassador to the Republic of Texas is listening tonight. I emailed him.
God bless you.
So where are we going with our special ability to discuss an obscure works by an obscure composer who probably 90% of the audience have not heard of or certainly don't know in enough detail to be able to follow whether or not Ringo Starr was rubbing his tape recorder with a cup of coffee or what? I mean, you were saying that, you know, we have...
No, we have a shared thing, but I predicate the shows that I do on Resonance and this on the basis of if you can find people that share one thing that gets them going, then you can tell from the energy generated that something good's going on, and you tune in and you learn things. Mm-hmm. And that there's far...
Michael Tense is probably listening to this in Australia at the moment.
Yeah. But the censorship of that, which is what conventional media do all the time, which is everything has to be comprehensible to everybody all the time, is what makes everything so dull. Mm-hmm. And that, therefore, it's not because I want to not communicate. I want to communicate, but it's got to have the libido, you know, the communicative libido in it, the feeling of I'm really getting somewhere, and you have to tap that where you can. And everybody's
that's a question,
you know,
that I'd like to put to Bob on that level, because it's, you know, is it in the nature of the medium that everything has to go that way, or is that in the nature of communication more generally? I mean, we can do this here because a large audience of several million is not required to be able to do that, but the moment it's scaled up, you can't do that because of the economics of the situation. But is it that the nature of the technology imposes that degree of censorship? Or...
Yes, that's where I bring in my four bodies, the chemical body, which we call the physical body, and the astral body, and the TV landscape, or TV body, and the chip body. The chip body micro-nanifies and matrix and decentralizes and defragments and creates resonance FN kind of stations. And so people need to fall back on a common shared thing when they go home and rest. So that's the function of TV, and that's why Fox News took over. And it's not journalism, it's to remind people of the familiars. So... the tactile is always 50-50. We're going more fragmented, more micro. At the same time, it's balanced off by the general. Now, that's what it was for the last 15 years or more. We're past that now. We're post-TV, TV body, chip body. So we're somewhere in this paleolithic retrieval of grabbing raw resources. And that's we're not communicating anymore.
Yeah. Have you? I keep asking Bob about this because I've noticed these bus stops with the Virgin... channel called Current, which is Virgin trying to get on the MySpace sort of scene, and they've invented a it's online and it's TV, and I keep wanting Bob to comment on this because you're talking about new media and new things, and this seems to be like the latest thing that's going to
that's a merger.
It's a merger.
Because the distinctions are not there anymore. In my chart, you have the chip body, the TV body, astral body, chemical body, all intertwined. Mm-hmm. So you'll have a new age channeler like Rampla having their own website and providing audio at the same time being on a TV show like Oprah and challenging the Catholic Church and advocating... some kind of Prozac, all mixed in.
Yeah.
And the young kids live like that. They juggle that. Well, so a corporate guy like Branson will bring in and play.
Their slogan is your music, your politics, your this and your that. It's all there for you.
Yes.
Well, the new move is to give everything. Google's challenging Steve Jobs' present command through all the AI products by giving everything away and allowing the consumer to steal as much as possible. That is going to be the new principle of knocking off Steve Jobs. Now, what is that? That's hyper-communism, and it's nihilistic, anarchistic communism. And so what is the common bond? It's advertising. So this article by Michael Wolff in the Vanity Fair, if you look it up, December 2007, he says we're back to the 50s where the advertising companies just want to get associated with the show. So the only economic afterimage in the present thing is that these ad companies want to be inside the environment, but the environment itself is being distributed freely. And that's what we through us better.
Look at all those hoardings all around London. They're all free, aren't they? I mean, you know.
Yeah. So it's not. So Branson's a bit obsolete.
See these things.
Branson's a bit obsolete. He says this is your space. No, no. He should be saying you can steal their space. Our technology allows you to steal all the MySpaces. But now try to figure out what the community is in that situation.
But there's still the imposition of it's your thing. You know, there's an assumption there.
That's the chip body's archetype.
Right.
Everybody's Rumpelstiltskin now.
It's the imposition of... I mean, I was in a pub the other day doing a pub quiz, not a natural habitat for me to inhabit, but I noticed there that it's about ticking boxes. It's everybody wants to have, you know, why is a pub quiz so exciting? It's so exciting.
I don't know. What is it?
Well, it's a very British thing.
Okay.
Everybody gets
together. It unites the pub.
Not so much, but it's also, it's ticking off things that people who belong to this culture should know in order to feel included in the group. And the more you know, then the more you are included in the group. And it's a very involving thing
is the riddle. So we have a riddling culture. It goes back to what's my line or whatever, $3,000-$4,000 question. Yeah, but that's Egyptian, and McLuhan and Burroughs agreed that we were retrieving the Egyptian under TV conditions in the 50s. So the riddling paradoxically flips into community recognition and consensus.
But this is not riddling. This is asking questions such as
everybody knows?
Well, they should know if they are participants.
But it's the form of the question.
No, it's like, what is the capital city of
Peru? That's a riddle. For some people.
Yeah,
I don't think it's a riddle.
It's not a depth riddle.
I don't think it's a riddle.
But it's the interrogative.
No,
Maybe I'll change it.
I think you're way offline there. I don't think it's a riddle at all.
Well, let's explore your relationship to that.
It's a question of fact.
Right, it's a question of fact, but it's interrogative. So yeah, I'm smearing the precise meaning of Riddler. The Riddler in Batman.
Yes, but a Riddler is asking you to come up with a creative solution to something, whereas this is simply asking you to tick a box. There is a right or wrong answer according to the, you know,
the standard consensus. Yeah. So that's a holdover of the matching Gutenberg technology, which the TV body does. But the chip is a riddling thing. Mm-hmm. That's why when you post something or about your book or something, then everybody attacks it, trying to create a riddling atmosphere in relation to you. You don't know why. They don't even have read the book, and yet they're attacking you. It creates a riddling. The Riddler.
I was forced by Andrew Greenaway of the Idiot Bastard website to go and perform a Zappa pub quiz in Bradford, or was it Stratford? No, it wasn't Stratford. Bradford-on-Avon, near...
Near the Zapateers, not the Zapateers thing.
Yeah, it was a Zapateers thing.
Yeah.
And the... Yeah, well, I went and did that. I had a great time. It was fun. Muffin Men played. It was a fun weekend, locked in a pub. And then the Zappanali, which is the Zappa fans, you all know what the Zappanali
Mardi
is.
Gras.
I'll tell people. It's the annual Frank Zappa Fest in what used to be communist East Germany, but is now part of in Bad Doberan, which Gail Zappa's trying to close down. The court case is happening just now. She's trying to stop it. And I did a quiz from the main stage, and I had a piece of paper with ticking off boxes. But of course, what I realised I could do with it is push all the names that I like, and I could make everybody think about the things that were pleasurable to me, and that I was doing a quiz. I was presenting a paper, really. I was presenting a particular view with because it's all, you're just making any question under the sun, so you can do what you like. You can, I put Marco Maritz's moustache as one of the moustaches to recognise, which one's Frank and all the rest of it, and mention Johnny Otis and all your favourite things. You can. So it's like being a TV chat show host. I mean, you can just shape what you like, drop names into people's brains, and everyone had a good time. They found it too difficult. I've been asked back as long as I did make it a bit easier, because they're like... The one question everybody got was, what is Vaclav Havel's favourite Frank Zappa record?
Bongo Fury.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't testing you.
Oh, okay.
I was asking you to reflect on
why it would be that.
And that's because it all fits into this East European... love of Frank Zappa from and it's very interesting politically, because we were talking about USSR and the Cold War and all the rest of it. And that's the people I always wanted to meet, people who might know about the Plastic People of the Universe in Prague, and what did Zappa mean to you if you were in the so-called socialist country and there was Frank Zappa records. But because of the language barrier, they all learned Russian, they didn't learn English. I find it very hard to find anyone to have proper conversations with about this stuff. But this fact that they all knew Vaclav Havel's favourite, that was the question they all managed to get right, practically. The top good question. It was illustrated that if you go to the Zappanali, you're getting something very different. Mm. You're getting the legacy of this popularity of Zappa in a communist era.
An underground thing, much more clearly.
Yeah.
Would it have been popular? Because in 75, 76, I assume that's when they heard it came out in 75, that's when they were all in prison. Vaclav Havel was in prison, the Plastic People.
Yeah,
it was like a very...
the record.
Intense for them.
Yeah.
Because they were in an intense, unpredictable situation. Yeah. That may be why it communicated to them.
And the aura of that record is quite desperate. It's a beatnik record, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like they unite in saying... it's the song against the 200th birthday of the United States. They're against sort of mindless patriotism, pointing out it's all an excuse to shift useless commodities. I always found that with the opening thing, the...
Abracadabra.
There's Debra Cadabra.
Debra Cadabra!
And then there's... what's the piece with the Mexican rubber goods mask, which Zappa writes for B-Fart?
Yeah.
And he has to say all these grotesque words, and I always found it like dogs baiting a bear. He's like a bear, and then all these twangs and words he's got to say, like, and he's been bothered, and he's
can't get them out.
So point and pointed.
Let's play the listeners an example.
Now, have you got any Bongo Fury on your CD?
It might be the next track.
Yeah, what? Track two?
Well, no. If you go down to about track five, you're getting a bit further in.
Yeah?
You don't have to play the next track. Just try track five, and if you don't like it, turn it off.
Yeah, if it is, it'll take it.
Everyone's got my taste.
Yeah.
Well, they tell me...
No, we can't...
Go to the next track,
then. Okay, next track.
Should
You heard right.
That's Frank. You mean you put that on first?
This is silent.
And I think it's silence. There's never such thing as
4:31.
This, as you might have guessed, is the end of the movie.
Ah, strictly genteel. No, no, I like talking. I really like talking.
No, no, no.
I enjoy talking.
You can see why they might have identified more intensely with that than the sort of more
and the beatnik thing. Since they were not,
it had this element of desperation, and it was revenge on the record.
Yeah, but guys, they weren't
all about how Virgin of
they called me a guy.
You know that they were against the record labels, and they were
part
of the whole beef art.
Where's Ellie Furlan Getty?
I'm waiting in line.
Furlan Getty.
I'm waiting in line.
Shelley likes books. Yeah.
But Gamma, listen to this. The technological mix of Prague in the 1970s was more like our 50s.
Well,
so you say
as
a 50 vibe, they could respond to that. Mm. Because they weren't into the cable TV exactly. set. They had not been massaged yet.
And it sounds like there's cigarette smoke in the air.
Exactly. Yeah.
And there's a cigarette, isn't there, on the back cover. There's a squash cigarette.
Yes.
And Havel smoked all the time, and Frank liked going there because everybody smoked still, and it wasn't...
Do you know the interview, maybe a Miles interview, where he talks about Electric Aunt Jemima, and he says, that was based on a conversation he and Beefheart had in 1962 outside of a coffee house, where we agreed on how we were going to change the music industry. Bongo Fury is them doing poetry or whatever they did in their high schools and in Cucamonga, the early 60s, and they realized they ain't going to work anymore. We got to come up with something totally different. Let's make a movie. So they started the Beefheart movie in 64. Yeah, Studio Z.
Well, the lyrics for Cucamonga, which is spookily like a song by Egg. I've never understood that. very, very strange.
The lyrics or the music?
The lyrics and the music.
Really?
About, it's a sentimental, nostalgic song which Egg wrote about their band.
Right.
I asked Frank, he'd never heard of it, of course.
Yeah.
You know, it's just one of those strange things.
Yeah.
And about how there used to be a time we lived in a van and we used to fool around with Janice, Liz and Anne. It was a happy time.
Does it have the same sort of punchline?
Yeah, it's got a similar... beating off the time and then the chord coming at strange intervals and the sort of squareness of it and all kinds of features are in this Egg thing.
But what about the punchline, that it would be crazy to be doing it any other way?
It's pretty much the sentiment of the song. Although, what was different, practicing for the time, we would go on TV, which kind of, as a typical Zappa, you know, you'd be set, if it's like Egg, it's all about how this band is like a really worthy, kind of nice sort of Canterbury Rock sort of thing where everybody sits around. And then this sudden cynical thing about going on TV.
Yes,
and Bob, what's your interpretation?
Steve
of that,
Allen,
right?
1963. Zappa, he gave Beefheart the idea, discussed, and he jumped in.
But Zappa went on as a solo artist.
Where's
Steve
my bicycle?
Allen. He played the bicycle.
I'm thinking of that, of the one where they did, he lip synced all wrong in the. That's what he's talking about.
Where you
go on TV. Because the actual song breaks into
But I'm saying that the expression of getting on TV, the first product of that was him getting on Steve Allen, because that's a Cucamonga days.
But is he saying therefore all this romantic thing and forming a band actually ends up with this stupidity? Or is it a good thing to get on TV?
Zappa believed content would change the world. He was very naive. He didn't understand the McLuhan Point, and of course he didn't know it. Mm-hmm. But he actually thought if they got on there. But it goes back to the assignment by the police department for which he got busted. Mm-hmm. But the ostensible reason was, hey, make a film of people that are weird in the little community and help the cops get used to these strange people and improve community relations with the freaks.
Mm.
That's the original agenda. It's a social welfare agenda.
But if content can't change things, one thing you said to me, Bob, is that it's important that you're not famous. And I always respected Guy Debord for not being famous because you had to wrestle with actually these texts. There was no reputation preceding it or going, but they were so electrifying that he is famous, so posthumously he sort of got done and it's kind of got useless now.
He screwed up.
But my method of not being famous is telling the truth. You know, it so annoys editors, you know, that they shut you out. They're not going to have you there.
Mm.
And so this station sort of keeps bubbling on. And the reason I do it is just occasionally you find a like-minded person gets in touch and you find another person to talk to. And is that why you do radio, Bob?
No, I'm actually trying to become famous over the next 100 years. I have a long-range agenda, but to survive that, I must be not famous for about three-quarters of it, and then surprise them.
Yeah.
In other words, I'm going to name Rumpelstiltskin.
Right, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And
but it interests me, this thing about, you know, they're naive, because Zappa's naive, he believes in content, that if you go, that if you, there is no way in which... that by getting becoming the biggest band in the world, you end up as the biggest band in the world. You don't end up saying anything.
That's right. You're the world's greatest singer.
Because in order to become the greatest band in the world, you must have people must have policed themselves into accepting that.
You are the brain police.
And that question was first raised by Tim Carey in his movie The World's Greatest Sinner.
Do you guys know the stages in that? Yeah, right. No. Okay.
Yeah.
You said that to me the other day. Timothy Carey, Kubrick, and Paths of Glory.
Paths of Glory. And then the later Cassavetes movies, Women Under the Influence. He's always
You said Cassavetes.
Yeah, John Cassavetes, is that Cassavetes?
Yeah, it means a lot to me, but you say like tomato, don't you?
Yeah, we're different cultures, man.
You're Canadian.
You know, I'm French. French-Canadian, American New Yorker, and going to Maui.
Like Cronenberg to me.
Listen to my tomato in 10 years after being in Maui.
I love you.
I love you. But the phases of The World's Greatest Sinner, do you know them?
No.
Of the movie. Have you seen the movie?
I've seen the movie.
All right. Doesn't he begin as a salesman?
Yeah.
Then he becomes a religion guy, then he becomes a rock star.
Sorry, yes.
And I don't know which... I've got the sequence, I think. Then he runs for president.
Yes.
He does the American dream of the successful power. Rumpel's taking over the whole scene. Mm. I'm pretty sure... And then Frank's running for president in 68.
It's like a blueprint,
And, you know, I saw a picture. Ben says he's seen pictures. Frank is watching... You have a picture of Frank standing behind Tim in some major street where the premiere in 63 for the movie is, and Tim's, you know, razzing up the audience, and Frank is just totally fascinated. He's watching it, and he's going to redunzel it. He's going to replay it, you know, but he didn't know that, I don't think, how it would come out, and begins with him getting busted, which becomes the metaphor for becoming the world's greatest sinner.
Mm.
And he's running for president by 68.
The Cucamonga bust is
the watershed.
It's the watershed. It's the moment, because he realizes what this system
does. Let's make the water turn black. What? Let's say I drowned Joe. What'd you say?
No.
We're not going to get it?
Hey, Joe. Where are you going to go?
Let's make the water. I mean, think of River Run. Water is such an important medium.
But there is something about content affecting the medium, isn't there? Given a certain amount of sexual content, this scandalous side of things, it does get banned from the radio and raise questions and so on. So, why is the medium message if this sexual content is actually creating problems and interesting maps of repression and, you know...
Ways to get attention. Mm. Because the nature of the medium after the satellite, and as it starts to shrink in the 60s, and then you have the beginning of digital, actually the form and the content merge, so content becomes very important. That's why Nixon had to be president in 68. They had to bring in the beginning of restricted, because the press conference from the White House ruled everything. Because there was no medium anymore. Baudrillard writes about this. He understands that the media had merged. There was no difference. So the form and the message become crystallized in what the press conference from the White House says. And we've been battling over that microphone ever since. That's why Frank, now we're getting into my esoterics, that's why in 200 Motels, Theodore Brickell, the military guy, is controlling Frank Zappa in the TV studio. The military is right there.
Mm-hmm. Rance Mohammed.
Yeah, Rance Mohammed. Because he knows that the military has to say that the UFOs have not landed yet, and all the other topics are camp secure, because you maintain the meme of control, and it comes from the microphone, the press conference, the president. So Frank knew that and started running, called it the interested party, the fascinated party. That was his name in the Kofsky interview for what he wanted to start. He's running for president because he knows he wants to get to be that microphone. And so he has the substitute Frank Zappa, who's a president in 200 Motels, Larry Dwarf, but he's saying, look, if I do that, I've got Rance Mohannis to deal with. Are you with me, people? Are you going to protect me? Of course, he had the assassinations that year of Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and then George Wallace. This is the nature of the new medium. McLuhan says in this Playboy interview done in 68 that the content is the present. is the medium today, and he italicized content. So you have to know the history of the division between form and media to see how it comes to be merged, which is Finnegan's Wake. There's no difference between the form and the content in Finnegan's Wake.
Right.
Another way to say it has no content, or it has no form, and it's tactile. So we really have a strange global little room. We're all in a room like Finnegan's Wake. And who's going to control this? Go to Hyde Park, which I did the other day for the first time in a long time. And the way people argue, they're really saying, no, listen to me for 30 seconds. And they go, another guy interrupts, and then he gets the attention, and they start listening to him for 10 seconds.
Yeah. Well, that's why they're
canceling.
I hate that.
Well, that is what the election of states is about. Who's going to get that microphone?
Yeah.
And be the android meme.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's...
Do androids dream of electric sheep?
Not anymore.
You sure?
The post-communication society, no more dreaming. We're all awake. We're all in struggle. Struggle, not struggle. Struggle.
Struggle, that's
yeah.
good.
We're in struggle.
Struggle and fight.
You know, if I was president, I would explain, I'd do what we're doing. That's how I'd run the government. I'd make people realize the drama of cognition in this medium. Mm-hmm. That's all they should do. That's all the president should do. Is discuss. You have the Socratic dialogue 24/7. And it'll drive a lot of people crazy, and they say, turn the goddamn thing off. You know, which would be good for a while.
More music,
and maybe, perhaps.
More
do you know? Do you know what's interesting? Lita Leskov was a columnist with East Philadelphia. Are we going in something else?
Right.
Okay.
I don't know what we're doing.
Oh dear.
Hey.
One of my mistakes.
Another error. Right. Are you on tomorrow, Ben?
Yeah, I'm on tomorrow.
Good. Yeah. I only brought that. Kind of a thing. Yeah. So dumb.
Thank you.
George bought his usual stock from a spanner in the works. With much chloral splendour, the creatures burst into life, producing the fountain of brightly coloured butterflies, old bottles of wine and tiny chairs and tables covered with the entire population of China. It wasn't the first time that this kind of thing had happened to George. None of the organisms expressed with a multitude of sins have at any time omitted a collection of complete turkeys packaged under train journey. Only when the room stood still did George realise that the blind elevator wheel stood on higher ground. The room played no part in the murder. A helicopter was an obvious choice, especially since demented camels panicked at the thought of being 80,000 miles from the Birkenhead without a silence of a lemon in a glass container served with a selection of Europe's finest cheeses. George knew the risks he was taking into the bed with him. George was always sitting at the foot of the grave with an ocean of guilt, but George didn't know the difference between three different types of raw fish.
Say tea or coffee?
Tea.
Tea? Yeah. Down with sugars?
Two.
Two.
Oh, sorry, one. George found the experience with the fish stimulating beyond his wildest fantasies. His mother always told him that a Volvo is safer than a mixture of the brightest aftershave known to man and beast alike. Champagne and beer never mix. It must have been like lemonade mixed with a long walk to find the keys that will open the gate into the shaft. The shaft being the only fairy that can tolerate the hairspray. The man stood naked on a hill, while Bob Hope went to Vaseline, a saw and giant octopus. The stairs were flat and the kitchen had a time for everything. George had been there in half past life whilst wearing a skimpy dress. In the lobby of the house stood a fishing rod, and Hollywood looked narcotic after midnight mass using a balut device. Only the lonely knocked out the fascist dictator and removed his body. George, wearing a plastic mask, masqueraded as the dictator long enough for the government to sneak into the next floor, drill a hole down into the light fixture to remove the growth and replace it with a new breed of mammal. Its name was Elsie and was knitted in a matter of seconds. George observed how Elsie symbolised a single incandescent beacon of subjective reality in a netherworld of endless absorbing reaches out toward a Mordian cosmos of nothingness. But the manor was the last thing on Elsie's mind. For the next bunch of Saturdays, the world was on the brink of turning into gigantic orbiting massive cottage cheese. It seemed that Elsie knew something about George that deflated Arab on a cruise to the asteroid belt, and even though George was not George. So if George was not himself, then what goes in must come out of the closet, my friend, and make your way down the chute. Meanwhile, at the manor, Captain Everything ever created and his fleet of smiling children sitting on a sunbeam were making their way down the upper chute lid, giving the impression of a famous doctor known as Bill. It was going to be an interesting funeral for a war hog from hell. One of the happy smiling children kept his feet firmly between his cheeks and the corner of two parallel lines, completing the never-ending circle of friends he had never felt were dead enough for a while. Captain Everything ever created wondered what was going on. Why had he been invited to the party stuck behind the kitchen cupboard? He recalled the time when Elsie was on her way home from the tattooed Yorker owners convention in Wales. She was attacked by a swarm of killer bees and goose hunters. Elsie stripped off all her clothing and jumped into her moped and headed towards the only man she knew. The secret that lay cistern at the public toilets at Wigan train station. Then, if hot, it's not the hot he knew. He ate his left leg for Lent and the jigsaw fell into place beneath his family tree. Elsie was planning her revenge. Captain Everything ever created was distracted from his own memory by a shrieked scream coming from the towel he stole from a barbell complete with leather and rubber. One of the Sunbeam children went before she ever was upside down, suspended in a vat of love. But the child knew it would fall completely into the washing machine. The washing machine found its way through the evening traffic, only to be terrified by a prostitute of enormous cooking ability. The man who was only breath away from her lungs, the table eventually fell into the kitchen sink and revealed that Elsie came very quickly as she bounced her way into a rubber replica of an atomic power plant, which convinced Captain Everything ever created that Elsie was the most evil creature known to man. Her razor-sharp fangs were displayed as the most compelling symbol of all. George leaped up and down. Elsie was not impressed. Captain Everything ever created spoke with the confidence of a pineapple walking through the park, only to be attacked 10 minutes after by a gang of milk bottles armed with vacuum cleaners, and the earth was flat by then anyway. "I'm here on a mission," he bellowed, "to convince each and every one of you of your potential of certain religious fanatics that might not be completely bananas in the shade."
Cut, man, cut. Cheers.
First time when Dogby's came in, this was about...
Mean there's something growing inside my head that's getting big old...
It was something
yes. Mean there's something growing inside my head that's getting big old...
God.
Yes. Mean there's something growing inside my head that's getting big old... Yes. This is one of the oldest operations known to medical science. Egyptian surgeons were doing it 1,000 years ago.
Interpenetrates the canal of one side, the knife pouring into it like blood from a butcher's peg. A leaden gob, slipped at zenith, first drop of violent night, spreads cataclysmically in harsh water of coming. There's the water, there's the ineffable movement and proprioceptive, caustic wreck at stain. A leaden gob, slipped at zenith, slipped at the peak, so it tried to touch the tactile and slipped away. Three trees above canal, sentimental, old nature, black and conventional in number, drive leaf blocks with jeering cries. What drives them? The three trees? Or they slightly bend their joints, impassable acrobats, step rapidly forward, faintly incline their heads. Or they slightly bend their joints, impassable, completely bend the joints, step rapidly forward, faintly incline their heads. So a gesture. There's a gesture. Across the moose mud, but he just says mud, across the mud in part of the canal, their shadows are gawky toy crocodiles, sawed up and down by infant giant. The Rumpelstiltskin electrified. E equals MC squared means you take one thing, it moves the speed of light, and it acquires infinite mass. He's anticipating Einstein here in 1914. Gollywog of Arabian symmetry, several tons, Argol, who was a person or something, drags them in blank, nervous hatred. What is blank? I guess it's like raw nerve percept. It's like a snake coming at you. Raw, blank, nervous hatred. He drags them. That's the earth. That's the beginning. That's the description of the first part.
Dogbiz.
You were listening to the first 17 minutes of Side B of Dog 01, BZ 04, Whackaroons Need Not Apply, by the inimitable Dogbiz. The reason that I faded it away is because we were chatting off air and then realised we were actually doing the stuff which we should be doing on air. And I was saying to Bob, I was trying to describe the different ways. By the way, Simon Prentice and Gamma have now gone. Simon has driven
this
Gamma
home.
This
is the final heat.
Yeah, many thanks to them for coming along. That I was trying to define how...
Define the medium first before you make your target is how you assessed my approach.
Yes, I was trying to define our different approaches, and I was saying that Bob seems to have a fairly objective, total view of different phases of planet Earth and society, and he lays that out as an explanation first of all. Whereas I go from my own reaction against things and wanting to articulate it, and then I was thinking, but these things do cross over because there are many other people's immediate reactions to the situation, which I go and try. You go to poetry readings, see if people get up and do poetry, or you read newspapers and authors write, and then I shy away from them. They haven't got it right. They're not expressing themselves correctly.
You're saying the same thing I'm saying.
So I start criticizing them, and in order to criticize them, obviously what I have to say is, well, it's not appropriate to be doing that. You're actually repeating something, and you're not responding, and you're not there. And then I have to get a little bit sociological. I have to think about history, and I have to
explain it.
And therefore I come over into your territory.
Yeah.
But I suppose what I'm saying is that I want to know where is the moment where you articulate your own expressive need for action and your indignation and your stepping out from simply being someone saying, but the world is like this and I can, you know, because when somebody says they've got a perfect descriptive system, I'm always thinking, yeah, where are you in this?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because I was, if I look at a drawing, I'm always thinking, well, where is the artist sitting and how did they put the pencil on and there was a body holding this piece of paper? And a lot of artists don't want to admit that. They try and produce a beautiful picture of a landscape which sort of floats from nowhere. And you don't know that. And this is why Cézanne is a revolutionary painter, because yes, he made, had impressionism was fantastic. It gave people snapshots, these extraordinary coloured snapshots which were so realistic, and once you shut your eyes a bit and all the flecks of paint went together, it was so vivid. But Cézanne showed that every time you put any paint down, somebody with paint on a brush was going there and there, making a decision, and so you got all this chopped, ugly, like, marks being made on the pain, and this ushers in the whole of modern art of showing that this is actually a person putting the paint down. It's not objective.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting for the moment when you're laying the ground and everything. Where is your? When are you going to admit that actually you are an expressive individual, one individual among millions, having your go, and that you're not in fact God?
I do that in my work off camera. I mean, I'm an intelligence agent. And that's actually, I've always said, the real artists since the late 60s are the intelligence agencies. And not the obvious ones, CIA, KGB or something, but the secret ones, which became known as Echelon in the 90s. You ever heard of Echelon? The agreement between New Zealand and the United States and Britain to monitor every bit of international communication. That's what Echelon does.
I'm shaking my head, so you can't hear that.
Which way you're shaking your head? You're going, no.
No, I'm shaking my head. We nod our heads.
Oh, nod nodding. Is yes.
Nod is yes.
Notting Hill. Notting Hill Gate.
Notting Hill, yeah.
So the Shakespeare, the great refusal from Shakespeare. So my creative and expressive stuff is in interacting with my teammates in the intelligence molding of the global meme. So my, what appears to be my public role, is me updating people on what happened up to, say, 67. So I have these known references that I publicly educate the people on, and that's just rear guard action. Hey, you guys, you're going over there, and you don't know you've already been replaced, and you're over there. So so a lot of what I say has nothing to do with how I live my life. Can you get that? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Nice. Now, the revolution is that when my personal achievements go on camera, which I said is going to be over the next 100 years, I make fantastic claims, and it actually happened, a lot of things I did, but those records are not released yet, and I don't want them released, because they would be lost in the confusion. McLuhan said that Castro was an incredible politician, because he used TV to be an educator, a warrior, and bureaucrat, and inspiration to the Cuban culture. He integrated everything. He took over the microphone, right? And nobody else was doing that, and he did it. That point of taking over the microphone, showing me being the massager, I don't want that apparent yet. So I'm talking about how the other people did it and explaining it so that you then can understand when I do go public what I'm referring to. So I'm educating, like Castro, the background to the play that's coming. So that's a long-term project.
Hmm. Well, I had this before about long-term projects, because I immediately compared you to Anthony Braxton and to a poet called Alan Fisher, and they both propose incredibly ambitious schemas of their works and how they fit in. And I was saying, no, your response to art has to be, it's fractal, that you can tell from a phrase in Joyce that he's fantastic. You don't need to be told, well, actually, wait, later on there's this and that and the other. And often these delaying tactics about an immediate response, well, you can't get what I'm saying at the moment, because tomorrow I'm going to do another symphony, and in that I'm going to, you know.
Wait.
And, you know, fundamentally, that Braxton Alan Fisher thing is, there's a good term for it, it's bullshit.
Right.
Because art's got to work straight away. You see a Wyndham Lewis picture or a Kurt Schwitters picture or a phrase by Joyce, and it makes your hair stand on end. It's fantastic. You know, by the texture. And these justifications about, well, this is my plan, listen, you know, are just, they don't excite me at all. They make me fall asleep. I can't stand them. I have to say that to you.
Well, I do my art on the radio or whatever medium. So I am doing a media. But people want to know, well, where are you coming from? Where are you going? So that's my explanation, but it's not necessarily
the deal. I don't mind. I just want good radio now, and I want insights now.
And that's what I do.
Yeah. And you're good. Yeah. When you're good, I really like it.
Yeah.
But the explaining the long-term Bob Dobbs plan makes him fall asleep.
Right, but that's, it's not relevant to you.
No.
I mean, you probably won't be around when I'm doing this. You'll be dead, long gone, maybe. Well, unless you get to know my wife and get treated.
Well, I've got some means of carrying on. You see, I think coining ideas makes... you're holding in your hand my book, Art, Class, and Cleavage, and in fact, if you look at the back blurb, it actually has something about immortality in it.
In the top part.
Yeah, it's various things, and one of them is...
Well, do you want me to read it?
Well, yeah, you could...
Ben Watson's Frank Zappa, The Negative Dialectic... Here it is. This new book is a defense of poetry, a rediscovery of Trotsky, a polemic versus or against Deleuze and Guattari, a manifesto of humanist Marxism, a satire on the Popsicle Academy, a materialist theory of immortality. So when I read that this morning, first time, I thought, oh, that's interesting. Mm. You know, this is what you do, interesting things, Ben. You get close to me.
There is a theory of immortality in it, but it's quite simple. It's that the idea that we die is the problem of individualism. And once we can find... I'm not talking about some, you know, the things that you talk about, some sort of biological continuation, which seems to me a projection from philosophy onto the biological body that I find quite grotesque. It's manipulative and not...
But I agree with that. I'm not just the opinion I'm presently explaining or using. Yeah. But go back. What's your immortality?
My idea of immortality is that if the knot of the personality could be untied, then death would lose its sting. Because we would understand how this whole thing being built upon the biological individual is actually something of a particular era in human development, and that when you understand that
we can do it, we can become immortal while still alive, is what you're saying.
You understand the true immortality of what you are is your contribution to the ongoing process, and that you can...
Now, a lot of people have that, and if Ben went to a convention of people who understood that, Ben would start saying, no, you guys got this all wrong. You don't understand that what you're doing is unconscious, and you aren't conscious of the principles you naturally feel. Everybody thinks they're contributing, no matter what they're
doing.
Of course.
They
have to think they're contributing.
Yeah, yeah, otherwise there's a certain sickness takes over. I mean, that's that projection towards the future and the sense of morals is absolutely inbuilt. Everybody thinks they're
so contributing. So distinguish your point from that.
Well, that the it's Boethius. It's constellation of philosophy. Yeah. I'm saying
right,
and it's that
that's Boethius. Boethius.
That this tragedy, so perceived, of death of the individual. Mm. Is no tragedy at all. It's an absolutely necessary completion of what we are.
Yeah.
You know, so it doesn't worry me at all. And I really admired the way Zappa was so prosaic about his own death and didn't go history.
And
on
he
it.
Said he didn't want to be remembered. Remembered. Mm. Remembered. He didn't want
That's
to be just
interesting.
Remember
he
said that? Is that isn't that a contradiction to the whole point you're saying that
probably,
he contributed something?
Yeah.
He didn't want to be remembered.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, he had this Francesco Zappa, his alter ego from the Baroque era.
Who did the same years, 63 to 88, which is amazing. 1763 to 1788.
Well, it's flourished, isn't it? Because they don't have his birth and death dates.
Right, but that's just the years of Frank's career, musical career. 63 to 88. Same years.
Oh, his career.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
200 years later.
Mm. Yeah.
Redunzel.
Mm.
We did it. Well, go ahead with anyways.
But when he celebrated Francesco Zappa, it was somebody who loved music and loved sex. And if he had those things, then the whole idea of posterity and all that didn't matter, because he's been so concrete about what he actually wants now. If he can get enough of that,
yeah.
And what is this? And I mean, I understand that as the desire for immortality and for fame and everything are a product of sexual repression, that a very Christian and repressed society produces people who have to live afterwards because they're not really living now. Whereas if we could really live now, we'd be quite happy with what we got.
Do you think that people have they act out their need for sex more today than they did 40 years ago? Don't you think society's evolved? I mean,
no,
people are into sex a lot.
They say they are, but I don't.
Again, there's been the critic. They've become the revolution.
I think there's a lot of misery. I think there's a lot of misery. I think there's a lot of acting sex. There's a lot of...
Now, how would you know there's a lot of misery?
Because sex hasn't been separated from security and identity and, you know, that sex is not a pleasurable... It's
too many signs associated with it.
Well, it's... So, survival is so bound up with it.
Yeah.
And of course, as biological human beings, I mean, as biological beings, you can look at animals and say, well, obviously sex and survival are related. But it seems to me that there are possibilities of a rational working out of what these drives could be and things that people want to do, which it wouldn't be that in order to achieve sex you have to, like, build...
the signs towards it?
Well, you wouldn't have to have a... it wouldn't all be dependent on...
of establishing something.
Yeah, of establishing what you are.
Goalless sex.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, goalless sex.
Yeah.
Well, when you're having good sex, it does seem to be, well, this is why we have life.
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the Francesco Zappa point of view. It's, you're turned on to, there's a reality in it that's, it seems to be this separate universe you step into, and you are the center of it, and you become like nature. You're no longer got all these kind of mortgages and things here that will happen then, and then,
or someone resenting that you had sex with other people, which may be the problem of Gail Zappa if Frank didn't help do the dishes enough, you know. The thing is, McLuhan said the most important thing in life is sex.
Oh, really? I never think of that as a McLuhanite point of view.
No, see, because you only know some Madison Avenue image of him.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is, I mean, Gurdjieff said the same thing. Sex is what we were, the moon controls the sex, and humans are controlled by sex. So sex is the being and release of life. It is the most important thing. But other people want that. So the confusion of relationships creates the philosophical quest.
Yeah, I guess it does.
Because you're communicating when you're doing sex, and others are involved. You're not alone. And then people, judge it.
I'm quite defensive of the stuff you do on your own as well.
Defensive? You
well,
mean supportive?
Not...
Isn't it funny if I take it the other way? I'm defensive about doing things on our own.
Yeah.
That's a good Leninist view.
In fact, I've often thought that the whole of Frank Zappa is about justifying masturbation.
Yeah. I think so. But then on my album that was made by others, they took a line, television is the thinking man's masturbation is the thinking man's television.
Yeah.
Masturbation is the thinking man's television. Because television is masturbation. So raw extension and rubbing of your tactility extended back to yourself. That's incredible. That's why everybody started screwing, you know, in the 50s, because television was reminding them of it or impelling them towards it. The Western version of tactility, sex.
Yeah, that's the word for it. And it's kind of an annoying word for it because it restricts it into something that isn't general enough.
The word sex is annoying.
Yeah, because it
It becomes S-E-C-T-S.
It becomes a speciality.
It becomes S-E-C-T-S. Sex. Religious sex.
Well, yeah.
Political sex.
Yeah. We know what those are like. They're not very good.
It's part of specialist life that industry brought in. It's an effect. But now we can't have sex. S-E-C-T-S.
We're beyond.
The microphone is the only sect. So whoever has it is everything, and nobody else is there. As Frank said, it doesn't exist unless you're in the media. This is what the kids understand. They got to get in the media.
And this is the emotional effect of doing radio rather than having a conversation in somewhere else, sitting on a park bench.
Now, this is, look
you
at
have
that.
A conversation.
You're having a discarnate sex here. We don't know who's listening. Mm-hmm. But I used to think when I got on the radio in the 80s, it was such an incredibly sexy experience. I used to call it the discarnate penis. That I thought everybody needs to be on, democratically, give them a show for half an hour to experience being inside or being the nub of it, then they'd understand why everybody's obsessed with it.
And you have to seduce people. It's like vampirism, you know, of you bite them and then they see the point. Because I would have nothing to do with this radio station when it first appeared, because the London Musicians Collective produced a magazine. Now, a magazine about music produced by musicians never has anything critical. It was a magazine just full of friends puffing their other...
Each other.
And it was, to me, there was no honesty or interest in it because it was just a promotional device. So I didn't like Resonance. I didn't want to be involved. But then...
Are you saying it was a magazine originally?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The name was... Yeah. It was London Musicians Collective had a magazine called Resonance. And then Billy Jenkins, who... I'd love to play you his records. He's England's greatest guitar... satirist.
Okay, I don't know.
Guitar player and satirist. There's a band called the Voice of God Collective, and he invited me onto his show. And so, because I like him, you know, I came on and we did 2 hours together. And then, of course, I suddenly saw the point. And
yeah.
I started having ideas for shows, and I started. And it's the same with when I have guests, particularly they've never done any radio before, and they're like, you want me to do a radio program? Oh, I'm really scared. I don't want to do it.
Naive virgin.
And then, but after they've done it, then they start having ideas about doing it.
Doing it.
And it's sort of absurd because you think, well, they're not stupid. They can imagine what a radio station is. It's got microphones.
Yeah.
It's got a mixing desk. It's broadcast out. But the actual experience of it...
Of being the center of the content going out.
Yeah.
You can't conceive it. But that's content obsession. They can't understand McLuhan until they actually feel the ultimate content generated.
And how are we being reflected now? Why is our conversation different now from... private conversations where the microphones aren't open. What do you think goes
ours
on?
Ours isn't different, because we're radio people.
So we just live publicly.
Yeah, we live publicly. The normal people, the Pinks, they broadcast themselves as if they're something to be received. They think, once McLuhan is arguing with someone, or just this person presenting some ideas to him, he says, well, you're trying to tell me something. What's wrong with mainstream broadcasting? They're trying to tell people something. I'm not trying to tell them. We're just trying to be. Yeah, we are being.
Yeah.
And so once you've been on the radio...
Yeah, I said this to my favorite poet, Sean Bonney. I said, people get really worried about writing poetry and they're going to write the best poem ever and they fiddle around with a silly few words. My idea is that if you live in the correct way, then anything you write is going to be great.
Yeah.
And he didn't agree with that. He went, no. And that no has really stuck with me because I really
you
like his poetry.
Him.
Yeah, and he builds his poetry. He said to me, I can't do what you do, Ben. Every time I'm asked to do a reading, I write something new. I write it out. I have to write it out. I can't improvise poetry because poetry is about this sort of weird thing of you write it down and then you can say it and there's a dialectic involved with the written page in poetry. There's also secretly a dialectic involved with score writing and free improvisation that they don't like to talk about too much, but it's definitely there.
But that's you. And then you were saying
I can't do this sort of improvised verbiage that you spill it all out, you know, and then you go and read it. And I said, well, yeah, I know you can't do that, so that's why your stuff's better than mine. Because he's found a way of thinking a lot about how it works, so it doesn't come out as like fiddled with and repressed. Most people who go and fiddle with their texts after they've written them, you can see
he's not fiddling.
No, they remind me of people who, you know, you do an abstract expressionist painting and then you go with Tippex and wipe out your errors. No, Sean's doesn't. Sean has got some idea of a.
He's actually improvising like you, but he doesn't do it. He thinks he's doing it differently.
Yeah.
Because when he's building, he's still improvising. No. If he's not correcting.
I think he's got a strong political idea of what his audience
needs.
Need to be told and effects that he can give to them.
Yeah.
So it's like. It's organizing.
And you don't? You don't have an idea?
No,
you do.
I've got no idea what they'll make of it, and I don't care.
Yeah, but then
I
you
just
go and listen to them, and you say, you guys don't know what you're doing. Massive contradictions, Ben, which
well,
is okay.
Yeah. No, this isn't worked out at all. The reason I'm telling you about these two methods of producing poetry is because I'm thinking about whether or not, whether we inhabit the radio world and so we open the mics and this is our general conversation, or whether there's any different tilt to what we're saying because the mics are open and we are
not with
radio.
Me.
You don't, not with you. Yeah.
And you know that. I'm just acting with you the way I did when we're off mic.
Keeping
the same things I'm thinking about.
Yeah. Well, that's pretty authentic. I mean, I I like that idea. I don't really want performances.
Yeah.
I mean, Derek Bailey was like that. I mean, his... He found the whole
like
thing...
Like what? You said two
well,
things.
Well, he
like
found
what?
Performance preposterous. He couldn't stand it. And he used to go upstairs to the Little Theatre, and sometimes there was no audience at all, but he'd still play his set.
Yeah.
And they thought he was crazy, but he said, I don't get a chance to play enough.
Yeah.
And here I am, I can play really loud, I can do what I do... And
that's your infantilism, the desire of the infantile to play in the feces or whatever.
Yeah,
that's
yeah,
what you like. Yeah. That's one of your aesthetic principles. Now, I come in, you say, Bob, you run the revolution. You got to write a book, which is an interesting statement. You're telling me to write a book.
Am I? When?
It was late last night.
All right. Yeah. Well, if you wrote a book, I'd be able to like put it in a frame. And write a response. I could write a review of your book in which I'd think densely about what you have
to say. I'd give you work.
Yeah, I don't get paid for most reviews.
Okay.
So it's not really a money thing, but it's more... There's a certain... practice, you know, which is people produce their book and you read it and you write a review, which is quite a good exchange.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's done properly, you know, where you try to get to the bottom of what the whole argument is, and you produce a response, and I kind of like that, and I like to do it to you.
It's how you talk. It's, you know, Sweeney Agonistes. I got to use words when I talk to you. You're saying I got to write a review of your book when I talk to you. I got to have a book when I talk to you.
Yeah.
Now, I would say there's no time for that if you're running something.
Yeah.
And you know that, and that's your dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
Why would I write a book just for Ben to review it? You know?
Well.
And most don't get reviewed. I mean, there's a whole pecking order. Just think of the millions of books are made, no one sees.
I've done some of them, so
yeah,
I'm aware of that.
You're a prime example of this dilemma. You're not successful like me.
Yeah,
you are trying to become visible. I'm successful because I remain unknown.
Yeah, well.
Which is what I state is the reason. I'm a follower of Duchamp in that sense.
But I can write a review of a book even though it's only an edition of one.
Yeah.
I mean, I can... Because it's concentrated the...
Does it have to be a book? Well, can you review my Up the Orphic Ante essay?
I should be able to review your website, but then I have an economic problem because there's only...
You don't use the website.
I can't because I'm not broadband, and therefore I'm not swanning around there.
No, I could just print it out and mail you the hard copy.
Yeah.
The two essays.
Well, that'd be a book.
Yeah, it'd be a little mini, a little J.W. Curry, little 100 edition thing, right?
Yeah.
Well, what do you call his books? Strangelets, booklets? What are those?
We're talking about J.W. Curry.
Now in Ottawa, I just discovered
when
he books you.
J.W. Curry. And he's...
What do you call the little things he produces?
Well, I like them. The reason I like them is I don't have a word for them, because when they started arriving, the first thing he ever sent to me was... scrounged paper, recycled paper, sewn together in thread. He'd done a course in Japanese binding with Biro written all over everywhere, sort of with a letter to me. It was a letter, but done in this way that was like a little book that he'd made. And then I found that he did this all the time to everybody, and he's producing his art. And you keep J.W. Curry's books because they're so special and fantastic when you get them through the post that everybody's got a little archive of J.W. Curry. And it just seems like the most fantastic way for an artist to behave. And it makes the whole business of making your name and getting the rich people all buzzed up about this is the next thing. And, you know, it just seems so irrelevant to actually making things which condense his experiences and his arguments, and yet make something that when you show it to someone, they just say, but this is just amazing thing you've handed to me. You know, you've got your hands in amazing
things. You live
thing.
As if you were a tribe in New Guinea and stay within your tribe, quote, primitivist, in the sense that you respect communication on a small scale, and you appreciate this guy's little craft work. That's what the Pre-Raphaelites tried to retrieve. This could be a heavy British meme.
But it's not... It's with awareness of what all the crap is going on elsewhere that J.W. Curry isn't...
It's an anti-environment.
He's aware that there's
Britney Spears. He's not a craftsman.
And
he's
Damien
an anti-environment.
Hurst. Yeah, he knows there's Damien Hirst and Britney Spears and Tate Modern and all this big rubbish out there. He knows it's there.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't really want to swap things with somebody who was a naive outsider artist who didn't have any anger about all that. So I preserve some platonic idea of the big abstraction somewhere.
Yeah.
Somewhere. Even though the best method seems to be to turn your back on it, but you are turning your back on something. And there are people who go around, you know, they make pretty things. They don't know that there's this battle, or they don't have the imagination about it. And I find that trivial. That's not interesting.
Now, Ben, we know that's half of you. The other half is looking for a fight and for the revolution. And John is J.W. is filling in while we're waiting for the fight. You do want to have a fight, right?
Mm.
You know? And I that's do, the other
yeah.
part.
Yeah.
But how would
J.W. you... Curry wants to have a fight.
Oh, does he?
Is he
a Trotskyist or something like that?
He's practical. I heard a description of his behavior at a poetry conference, and it was such the perfect critique of academia, of actually doing it.
Okay.
And he's at a poetry conference, and what he does is he talks to people in the print room in the university complex, and they take over this print room and start producing books. And the people who work in the print room start having ideas and producing books, and they get this photocopier working, and they're just producing poetry books. And he includes them, and the pecking order people are just freaked out by this.
That
this isn't what you should be doing.
We don't want to include the employees.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they're not poets. They're just people hanging around. And
so that's like going into the factory and getting the workers excited.
It's like an occupation, isn't
it?
It's like when everybody... Because that's when love... and hope and all the good things really start happening is during revolutionary times, when we seize the things that make stuff, and we allow our trust in each other to be the social network rather than all the money worry and anxiety.
Was that the charisma of the early mothers?
No.
They didn't have that?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think they're a revolution. I mean, this is May 68 in Paris, or it's 1917, or it's Portugal in 74. These are revolutionary moments. The Zappa thing is it's like a commentary on everything. It's like trying to produce something in a petri dish, dropping germs in and being very aware of it. And it's fascinating. It's so interesting that you can't not look into it. But I'd never hold it up as a utopian, you know, prevision.
He's not a J.W. Curry going into the factory.
No. No, he's not J.W. Curry. No, he's got a whole bourgeois composer complex thing.
Yeah.
And he works through it in a way that sheds light on that. And
I think it comes out of his poverty, lower middle class, lower class, whatever poverty.
Yeah.
He did want to become an American in that sense, not a European.
Yeah.
Sociologically speaking, that's what he was. I mean, Nigel Lennon, people say, he was very old-fashioned.
Yeah, they say that his line on communism was sort of like an anti-communism lecture at school from the 50s. You know, sort of, you're not allowed to have anything.
Well, do you know that, you know, how he has in his autobiography the theory of his father, everything comes out of Sicily?
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
I met a lot of people the last 7 days, whatever it's been. Someone presented that to me the other day. They had the details on how it was Sicily. Oh, I know, it was that Robert Bridge guy. He knew a woman who was an Albanian who explained that it all came from Sicily and then went to Naples.
Yeah.
Which I thought, well, man, maybe that's what Mr.
Sicily
Zappa knew.
Is sort of nearly the middle of the Mediterranean, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, if the Mediterranean is all this
crisscrossing. It's like a Venice. It's the lower Venice.
It's all this crisscrossing
trade
and communication. Then
the
Sicily
lower Venice.
Pretty important.
Yeah, that the lower Venice. Venice, everybody was down here doing another.
Well,
Venice.
Venice is when you start exporting it to the north, isn't it? So you've got all those routes up there.
So the Naples, the Sicily is the Venice of the south.
The thing I thought you were going to say, talking about his dad, was the way his dad was very skeptical about written history.
Yeah.
And had a whole
oral thing
that you can't believe what they write down. And that skepticism in Frank about the written as opposed to the stories people tell is just it's an amazing bouleversement of your world, particularly if you've been very committed to books.
Yeah,
it's the opposite.
But you know what he did? He argued with his father's love of Shakespeare. So the oral man worships the literary man on some level.
Yeah, well, Shakespeare is pretty Finnegan's Wake-ish.
Yeah.
I mean,
so maybe that's what he saw.
I mean, Finnegan's Wake, I mean, Shakespeare is the transcription, the way I look at it, is the transcription of events, which were the plays, which were situations created by everybody.
Yeah.
And somebody wrote down all the stuff that William was getting them to say. It wasn't William sucking his pencil and writing it all out cold.
That's Francis Bacon.
It's a transcription of of this event, which enabled all these people to get really articulate.
It's oral culture.
Yeah, so in a sense, it is oral culture.
I showed my own bias. I thought he meant written Shakespeare. He might have meant Shakespeare plays. Well, not the books.
They're written to be resounded. There's a whole... Yeah. I have a whole problem with it. When I write my poetry, it comes out in blank verse because we played Shakespeare at school and I used to be worried about it. You know, I've got to get away from this. I've got to, it's too traditional. But then I think that's the way the English language does boom. That's the way it sounds loud. That's how you can get it working. So that's good.
So how's Zappa against the oral presentation of...
When I went mad, I believe that Frank Zappa was a new Shakespeare and worked in a way which was to go to a particular spot he'd never been before. He'd work his way up. He'd sit in a pub, meet a few people. He'd have some money that allowed him to ask them to do this and that. And then he'd create a sort of crazy situation where everyone would find partners and lovers. Like the end of Shakespeare play, everyone's married off. Yeah. You know, the hero and heroine, but then also the sort of ugly one finds an ugly partner, and everybody's married off. And Zappa would do that, and the end product would be an album. And everybody thought he was producing records. But this was
theater.
He was actually producing situations in cities by working with what he could work with. He was like, an entrepreneur or something that came in and
like J.W. Curry, creating a workshop. Isn't that kind of similar?
Well, J.W.
Curry... You have walked into the opposite side here.
I'm trying to get back to a point that wasn't finished being
Well, we're talking about the father. The Naples.
Yeah, and his skepticism about written history and how deep that is and what a shock it is that Zappa is a very carefully constructed shock for the literary the sort of person.
The Grant economy.
And, you know, the apprentice studied literature at Oxford, you know. And,
you hear what I said? The Grant economy. He was a critic of that.
The?
Grants. Grants.
The What's Grant. That?
Well, you know, in North America, and I guess here, all the art groups live on grants.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely.
What do you call them? Maybe you don't say the word grant.
Yeah. What do I call them? Craven, fun-seeking crumbsuckers.
Yeah, they get the crumbs.
They are the plague. They are the death.
Yeah.
They are why the art world has nothing interesting in it.
Mm.
And Frank is very good on the art world about his committees of white wine drinkers. There is absolutely nothing. Resonance occasionally has programs like this with artists sitting around talking.
Mm-hmm.
And the emotional atmosphere of these people talking to each other is poison.
Mm-hmm.
There's something around the art world about arguing for what you do, my work.
They don't know they're on the radio. They're really showing the unconsciousness of the medium.
They have to be stopped. You know, art must be stopped because it's absolutely complicit with...
Oh, you agree with me. You believe in shutting down art, yeah.
Absolutely. The
is that right wing? Cut the funding? That's what they attempted.
Yeah, I know.
But they were doing it for backward reasons.
I find it difficult to...
What the heck is your socialism or Marxism? Would it be almost anarchistic? I mean, what is it?
It's revolutionary Marxism, so I believe in workers' councils. So I believe in this sort of J.W. Curry thing and the people where they work taking over and their freedom. I've tasted it on in supporting strikes and so on. You go down as a Trotskyist sort of political agent.
Yeah.
But you get involved with this whole sort of festival of what people can be.
Yeah.
And the kind of hacks that I used to work with who weren't that good at actually talking to people but had all the politics would be amazing because I'd go down there and of course I'd start talking to them about things like Frank Zappa or the Sex Pistols and with music you can communicate
you
with people.
You had things to talk about, you're saying.
That there's a whole... The people I met during the hospital strike in the early 80s in Leeds, they were the ones who were going down to these women who were, they were heterosexual, but they had to go to the gay clubs because only there could, they were free of all the usual nonsense. And they were people, they were trying to live.
Yeah.
And going on strike was their attempt to really live and not just survive and to criticize everybody and the,
So you were the poet when coming into this living organism and doing poetry by just bringing up topics that made them think about what they were doing.
Well, no, I was somebody who was forced to go along there because I was convinced of the politics of the Revolutionary Party. They said, we've got to go along to picket lines. But what you actually find on picket lines, of course, is actually people realizing we don't have to put up with all this nonsense. We can run it all ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And when it gets more, when other people have heard of the strike and they start supporting it, and when you suddenly realize a lorry driver decided not to cross the picket line, he's in charge of this massive machine and he can turn it around, go away again and do what you want. Yeah. And you start to think all this stuff around us could be used for us, in a good way. And
why?
It's why the size of vehicles is really important. I noticed on the anti-war demonstrations that if it's like a mini car honked a horn, we'd cheer, but like if a 10-ton truck the driver honks his horn, everybody on the demo goes bananas. They love it because it's all that's on our side. All
that's
that
the extension.
Yeah.
See, that's our self joining in.
Yeah.
Our extended machine self.
Yeah.
Now, what has happened to all that? Is it just pockets of temporary autonomous zones? Or is that not happened? Does it not happen anymore?
Well, it seems to be. I'm getting more. I keep tripping over protests, and things are hotting up on that.
Yeah.
In that area, they definitely are
now because then everything's disappeared.
Well, because prices are going up, and they won't give us any money, and I mean. But I'm taking Iris to Treetops, which is a very nice place for kids to climb around in Kentish Town, and the Unison have got a magazine. I look into it, it's all kind of socialist worker type. I know all the names, but they've got the pamphlet there of this lefty union sort of denouncing everybody and everything and sort of just there for taking away for all the parents, that's surfacing, that's a breath of something. When I say to the woman who's been nice to me about some problem, oh, it's nice we've got some lefty propaganda around, she smiles at me. Well, 10 years ago that wouldn't
Is that right?
So there's something bubbling over, and Didier Mervollet, the general secretary of Les Fils de l'Invention, who's politically, once he just decided I was so raw and Marxist and unsophisticated and believe in workers' councils and things have got more complex than that, and he was sort of to the right of me. Now he's excited by students in France and he's giving talks to them, and we're going to present a on the 10th of May at Conway Hall, there's something organised about May 68.
Right.
And Didier and me, we're going to take the bull by the horns, we're going to talk about Frank Zappa in May 68. And of course, conventional opinion will be, he didn't like the German, he's a reactionary capitalist, but we're going to try and explain to everybody.
Didn't we say 10 minutes ago he had nothing to do with that?
Well, absolutely, he didn't. I mean, he was critical of it, but this discussion is the heart of without this discussion, all this boring nonsense, that this debate around Adorno's there. I mean, Adorno and Zappa agree. They're both very critical of the revolting students. Their positions are very similar. And simply saying, well, you've got to cheerlead everything the students do is kind of crazy, because they didn't win, so we've got to think about what they did, and because Zappa hones in on the subjective
side,
he's
a critique of it, he gives something to talk about.
The idea of revolution is we get rid of the difference between subject and object. Well, people talk objectively about left-wing politics. Where's the subject? Where's the thing you want to do? If that isn't there, how can we motivate anyone? It's a moralistic, boring thing that's like a ways on the left, like a...
So Zappa was a magnified subjective expression to create a dialogue, create an anti-environment temporary, like Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah, yeah.
He was Lewis.
Though, politically, I kind of prefer Frank to Wyndham.
Oh, yeah.
Because he's after the blues, The blues was such a contribution to...
Music is the best. You can't beat music.
I mean, it democratized and it globalized in ways that trying to be the absolute overthrow of literature. I mean, blast, it's like seeing what newspapers could be. But Wyndham Lewis is, I think he's the oaf of theory.
Right.
But
did you get my point? Music is the best?
Yeah.
It's a very powerful, potent force.
Well, I mean, it was visual in the 20s, the revolution, modern art.
Yeah.
In the 60s, it was musical.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Now it's tactile. Digital is tactile. Well, interface, my face.
Yeah, but I
you know how the
find
kids
the
dance?
Digital revolution. I don't get it.
I don't know if you know this. The anti-environment to a culture, to the kids living in MySpace, interfacing all the time. You know what they do when they go party? They dance not facing each other. Do you have that over here? This is how they dance. The woman gets her, the young girl gets like that, and the guy gets behind, and basically...
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's the a blues. You call that in Leeds, in Chapeltown,
yeah.
In the Caribbean, Jamaican area. That's their way
is
of dancing.
Is it Mardi Gras kind of dancing?
No, that's sort of carnival-esque down the street. But
right.
It's very packed, and you've got big speakers, and it's reggae, and that's how you dance. And it's dark, so that you can really... You're practically...
It's called grinding in
yeah,
North
you're
America.
Practically doing it. You
know? Right. So the point is that they do not do interfacial contact when they're dancing.
Mm.
Because that's what they live every day. That's their work. Interfacing. Intertexting.
Mm. Mm.
So they don't face each other as a release.
Yeah.
That
yeah,
would be the why that fad comes in.
Mm.
It responds to the sensory. It's not even a fad. It's just a sensory response to the other daily sensory interaction of disconnect intertexting.
All right. You mean that you could get the little camera on your computer.
Yeah.
You've got a face changing not very quickly, sort of
Facebook.
In the corner.
Facebook, MySpace, face.
But you're finding a dialectical opposite of what the digital media do.
Yeah.
But then when you, I always have this with you, when you start talking about it, you go, but it's the digital media, and I'm thinking, he's a cyber booster. I can't get, you know.
Oh,
and
no,
then
no.
You
I don't. I'm not
things.
Being enthusiastic.
Yeah,
I'm explaining it enthusiastically, but I'm not. It's like McLuhan used to say, I never approve of what I talk about. So I'm excited about what the meaning of what I think I'm communicating, but it doesn't mean I promote it. Actually, I'm just setting, I'm diminishing it by saying, look, here's a reaction to it.
Yeah.
So we don't need to look at what digital media, look at the translation, grinding.
But it's so important. When I wanted to criticize Deleuze and Guattari, I wanted to talk about the reception among a particular set of people.
Yeah.
The theory does not exist in a, is it true or is it not? You've got to look at people's needs and why they should adopt something. And for me, Deleuze and Guattari are like the Doors. They're an adolescent transitional thing. You've left the family and you come to this hostile world where you need a job. And Deleuze and Guattari are perfect. You know, they fit for that, which is why, of course, they're not philosophy, because philosophy doesn't appeal to a particular...
Yeah.
Set is trying to think everything, so it's not going to, you know, sell to them.
Yeah.
It's, you know, history is actually made by people. This is Vico. No.
And we made the digital space.
Yeah.
Slavery helped create conditions.
Now, I want to read some Finnegan's Wake. I want to read that paragraph.
Okay.
That you talk about that nearly has Marshall McLuhan's name.
Yeah. Page 254.
Because I think I read it out rather differently from you. Maybe we should...
And then we'll do the page 614, maybe.
Yeah, 254. Yeah.
The top.
It's the top. Was he pitched for an example as certain have dogged nose of him against our seawall by Rory, Thwath and Cleaver, those three stout sweenhearts, Orion of the Orgias, Mira Shal MacMuin, the Ipsy Dadden, product of the extremes, giving quotidians to our means, as might occur to anyone, your Brutus Laerman with the Princess Champion Archdeaconry, or so yclept from Cleo's clippings, which the Concher of Chivalries is suspicious save his scan, for ancients link with presence as a human chain extends, have done, do, and will again, as John Polycarp and our news eye to eye, eye witnessed, and to Paddy Palmer, while monks sell you to archers, or the water of the Libyan goes the way of all fish, from Sarah's drawhead, the quarrelsome, to Isaac's, the laughed but one, with a minilisp exterior to his monoloth in turn. So Pericon with Bastien, or Heavy Humph with Airy Nan, Rick-a-racker, brimmer, billy, jicky, jocky, jockey, jolly, jolly cass. How some thou dulcimica, and ah, ab, ad, abu, abiad, a babble men dub gulch of tears. Would you like to do some?
I'd like to exegete that.
Okay. Yeah, exegete it. That's a good idea. And we'll probably be finishing with that.
We got, what, 9 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, this is a section that Marshall McLuhan thought described him. Page, top of page 254, Finney's Wake. And I've seen, and I have Xeroxes of Marshall's copies of Finney's Wake, and he put opposite the Mirshel MacMuin, me, meaning himself.
Yeah.
So he understood that this This was the linguistic...
Well, he thought it meant himself. Actually, it meant militant aesthetics.
Yes. No, it's true. Here comes everybody. But the thing is that it does the language... Joyce, the linguistic unconscious predicted McLuhan. And it's his exact method and his theory, what he's known as, theoretically. Was he pitched for an example? In other words, was he looking for an example? As certain had diagnosed. Now,
I hear that. Was he pissed, for example?
No, that's okay. Yeah. I just wanted to show, bring it in. McLuhan was always looking, they said he was obsessed with metaphor. So I'm thinking of that as example. Looking for examples. But diagnosed. McLuhan was a Manipian satirist. Technically, Manipianism comes from the philosophy, Diogenes' philosophy of cynicism. And their symbol was the dog. So McLuhan, like Zappa and Joyce and Lewis, didn't diagnose. They dognosed. They presented themes for you as any environment. They satirized you because you were looking for a diagnosis. So they dognosed and osmic, the nose. They sniffing. Mm. Fido.
Yeah.
Right there in dognose.
Yeah.
As certain have dognosed of him against our sea wall. Now, isn't that your... the watershed.
Oh, it's a seawall. Well, it sounds more like an attempt to keep the sea... I mean, a seawall is keeping something away, isn't it?
And he's against it.
Yeah.
He's against our seawall.
Oh, he's totally against that. I mean, Joyce... That quote from Parnell that gets punned on throughout Finnegan's Wake about how can anyone set the bounds to the marches of a nation?
Yeah.
And it's against these borders and...
Right.
These carving up the world as a nation state.
And the seawall is created by Ruri, Thoth, and Cleaver. Thoth would be the wall that the phonetic alphabet created. All for a bit, Balbus is building a wall.
Thoth, the god of writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Cleaver. Those three stout swain hearts, Orion of the Orgias. Now, the 60s was an orgy, and Baudrillard wrote about it, a famous essay after that, 70s, 80s, called After the Orgy, and the exhaustion. So McLuhan is there, like Zappa in the Life magazine article, enters the orgiastic disco and says, what if someone interrupted your dancing and presented a diagnosis of the situation and whether we could use this ourselves as powerful force? McLuhan was like that. He was an interrupter of the pleasure. So Orion of the Orgias, Myrtle McMuhan, the Ipsy Dadden. Now, Mechanical Bride, his first book, is based on Duchamp's Nude Descending Staircase. Is that what it is?
The painting or the...
The painting, the Nude
not
Descending...
Not the bride stripped bare.
No, the Nude Descending Staircase, 1914 or whatever it was. The Ipsy Dadden, I see Dada in there. Dadden, Daddy. Product of the Extremes... Now, he was seen as an extremist, a technological determinist, who was giving quotidians, or making it cliché, to our means. Our means are our media. How is our means of communication? So he was a product of the extremes, giving quotidians to our means. That's the book from cliché to archetype, from the quotidian to the means or the extreme. As might occur to anyone. If you explain people to McLuhan, you start saying, you know, the book is an extension of the eye. Of course. That's obvious. You get that reaction all the time from neophytes. You know what I mean? What's the point here? Yeah, so what? You know? So he's taking these trivial perceptions and making them extreme, saying they're the be-all, end-all, the clue to hidden social change. Mm-hmm. These things that might occur to anyone, but they never did occur to anybody.
It's very Benjaminian, that.
Yes. Who he was a friend of Siegfried Gideon, and so was Joyce. Gideon is a key guy in McLuhan
Land. It's these, well, you call it trivial, but it's these immediate observations, which kind of this is why gamma helps.
Yeah.
That everyone gets too sophisticated to make. So seeing what people are actually doing, sort of through all the kind of...
He grunts. You know, the ground of what we're doing. He reminds us.
Mm.
So... this that might occur to anyone, your Brutus layman. Now, he was a layman professor at a Catholic university. Most of the teachers were priests. With the princiest champion in our archdeaconry. So he was
Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah, he was a layman at St. Michael's, a Basilian college.
Right.
And he and Don Thiel, there weren't too many of them. They got paid nothing. It was in the 50s. And the majority of teachers were priests. So he's a layman with the princess champion in our archdeaconry. Or so he clipped from Cleo's clippings. When I did McLuhan's archives, organized them, all his writings from all the different period, a lot of it was newspaper clippings. Now, Joyce doesn't mean this, but when we know what McLuhan did, the language anticipates his method. So, or so he clipped from Cleo's clippings, it even gets better, which the cruncher of chivalries, he was a medievalist. That's what his grounding was at Cambridge in the 30s. The cruncher of chivalries is suspicious, save he scanned. He emphasized that the TV camera, TV monitor, was a scanning mechanism. Okay? And he said it retrieved medieval sensibility. So, he was the cruncher. In other words, he dognosed. He said, okay, we're going medieval because of TV. But he wasn't for that. Everybody thought he was for that. He crunched it, if you really saw what he was doing. Which the cruncher of chivalries is suspicious, save he scan. Save can be accept he scan, or whatever the other meaning of save is suspicious. For ancients link with presents, and that was his thesis. His thesis was about the ancients versus the moderns, his PhD thesis. And he said that the vorticists, Pound, Lewis, Joyce, especially Pound and Joyce, believed that or acted as if all times were happening via the medium of language. So the ancients link with the presence. Get that? For ancients link with presence as the human chain extends. There's the McLuhan word, extensions of man. And he says, as the human chain extends, have done, do, and will again. And then he goes into the eye-ear with the eye-to-eye, eye-witnessed. And then it goes into other things. But I think that's pretty crystal. The other quote...
Yeah, no, we don't have time for that. I just want to say... something, which is that...
Can I read a sentence from you about Finnegan's Wake? Page 58, it's just short, but it fits in. You go, Finnegan's Wake, this is page 58 of your Art Cleavage book, Finnegan's Wake was a much more realistic assessment of the power, quote, the power of literature in 1934, as simultaneously useless and necessary as dream work. That's a very good statement. It's a preliminary to understanding McLuhan's take on the Wake.
The way you expound it reminds...
The way expounded the page
The way you expounded it, the way you find your...
my Rorschach
your particular
plot.
Method sort of enshrined, sort of worked out in there, reminds me of how I've used Schwitters.
Yeah.
And that if I kind of wrote like that about what I think Schwitters does, I would be describing thinking, and I would be able to... sort of expound everything that I thought thinking actually is.
If you did Finneganese on Schwitters.
Yeah. If I thought about when you find an artist who cuts right, it makes you articulate.
Yeah.
And that's the academic approach to art can't do that because it makes it an object which you then become an expert on and you keep it dead.
Yeah.
But what we're trying to do is actually make the get the art to do what it should do, which is stimulate us into articulacy.
McLuhan's thesis was that we need to retrieve the rhetorical grammarian tradition that you aren't wise unless you're eloquent, and eloquent can be updated to articulation. That's exactly his point. That's why in your books you expound, and maybe the Cambridge influence or something, where McLuhan came from, you're expounding the wisdom and the principle of the vorticists. It's just that I add the update of, quote, new media. But you've got the grounding as a literate person.
All right. Well, it's
with an
nice
oral bias. You're an underminer of the non-tactile. You're a tactile, Ben.
Okay. All right. Well, I accept that. This is, we're very near the end of our show. I want to thank Bob Dobbs very much for coming to London over the last few days and putting my head in the whirl, and I've just found it a really stimulating time, you know, and this is this is helping me think, you know.
Yeah.
It really helps.
And so when I get
I just hope that people have enjoyed this rather than just thinking that
we're wankers, which is what we're doing,
completely insane.
But I want to say, Ben, I enjoy someone responding. Okay. That's where I get life.
Good. And just to say that if you like what you heard and want to hear me again, I'll be playing music rather than
a lot of words. It's Wednesday at 2 is when I do my show. And Bob, do you want to say anything about people want to follow up your website or something like that?
Go to 5body.com. I think eventually this conversation will be on there, but there's all kinds of other stuff, and it gives a clue to how I'm going to take over the world.
Right. Good.
Well, maybe the worlds. Plural. Plural. Worlds. Yeah. Well, how it was done. I already did
it. Right, now we go over to shuffle mode for the rest of the night. Resonance will get off shuffle mode and start having proper stuff tomorrow morning.
Resonance, FM 104.4, London. Resonance, FM 104.4, London's first radio art station.